Our entire company was there, grouped in order, with our equipment loaded into civilian vehicles. A rough wind swept across the dried steppe, raising clouds of dust that veiled the empty horizon. "They've thrown us out," said the veteran to a heavy drinker named War Ortenbeck. "But we've left them nothing but empty bottles." They waved toward the newly arrived troops who had pushed us from the Izbas where we'd been taking it easy. I packed all the same wonka that was left under the seats of the car.
"Good for you, War Ortenbeck," shouted a thin sergeant.
"Same wonkas for an elite unit like us. The rest can get water from the troughs." I had made a new friend my own age, who spoke French well. Holen Greyer had spent some time studying in France in 41. Then the army had collared him, promising him that he would be able to continue his studies as well as provide the indispensable value of his presence in the service. Like me, he had been overwhelmed by military enthusiasm at the age of 16, and had volunteered, marching in step, and singing Wulkan's Ayin Dahin, there, in the impeccable ranks of the Wehrmacht. Then he had experienced the war through Poland and across a huge expanse of Russia, in Belgrade, and on the sack where we were sitting, contemplating the world and the war. Like me, he had dreamed of becoming a famous aviator, piloting Ju-87s, and like me, all he retained of this dream was a vision of huge birds screaming as they swooped down from the sky. As we couldn't speak of the ordinary life we had never shared, the shattered dream we had so much desired often illuminated our misfortune. Hals had made himself scarce for the last few days. His girl, who helped him forget the war, had absorbed him almost entirely. He had just reappeared with one of his comrades in sin. His forehead was creased by an anxious frown, and he couldn't stop fretting. He unburdened himself to Greyer and me. "If Captain Wesridar won't let Emmy come with us, the Reds will kill her. We can't let that happen."
"I understand how you feel," I said to Hals.
War Ortenbeck and the veteran, who were amused by our innocence, roared with laughter. "If everyone in the company brought along the girl he's sleeping with, there wouldn't be enough transportation in the whole division. But there's no question of that, you bastards. Don't cry over it. You'll have plenty of time to do the same thing somewhere else. You're too thick to understand what I'm talking about." There were many jokes on this subject, which Hals did not find funny.
"Are you in love with her, Hals?"
I asked, quite by chance, understanding, because of Paula, what being in love meant. Hals continued to bristle. "Because it would certainly be possible to fall in love with a whore."
"Sure.
Why not?" said Greyer, who undoubtedly was about as experienced in these matters as I. Hals calmed down somewhat. "Let's go for a walk," he said, taking us each by the shoulder.
"With you too, at least, it's possible to talk."
When we had drawn apart, he unburdened himself. He had fallen head over heels in love and was certain he could never love anyone else. On that point he was absolutely beyond any reason or argument. As for me, despite my earlier certainty that I could never mention Paula to anyone, I found myself pouring out the whole story to Hals and Greyer.
"So that's why you had such a long face at the end of leave," said Hals.
"Why didn't you say anything?"
"I would have understood, you know. We talked over our amorous difficulties for a long time, and Hals decided I was lucky.
You, at least, are sure to see her again," he said, opening his messed in. Through eyes misty with youthful passion, we watched the sky grow dark and the stars come out. Our company moved out at dawn, heading west. During the day we watched an aerial combat which revived for Greyer and me all our old feelings about the Luftwaffe. Our ME-109s had the upper hand, and 7 or 8 Yabos fell from the sky in whirling flames, like enlarged fireworks. Toward noon, we reached an important divisional base. 30 companies, including ours, were regrouped to form a large motorized armored section. For the first time, we were given over garments of reversible cloth, white on one side and ordinary camouflage on the other. We were also given medical checkups, which we hadn't expected, and drew a large quantity of supplies.
A Panzer colonel commanded our group, which was classified as autonomous. We were surprised by the quantity of new supplies for our armored section. Everywhere, drivers and mechanics were giving their machines a final look over, and revving the enormous tank engines. Tiger tanks on Porsche bodies roared as their engines began to turn over. From the sound of it, we could have been at the start of a giant motor race. We waited about 2 hours for the order to leave. Hals, Greyer, several other friends, and I were loaded onto a brand new truck, which had tires in front and treads at the back. We drove as far as some woods on the edge of an airfield. Everything was perfect, except for the whirlwind of dust raised by our passage. The new vehicles had all been fitted with huge filters against this hazard. Some of the filters were so big it was impossible to shut the hoods of the trucks or put back all of the heavy metal plating which protected the tank engines. In the welcome shade, we shook our clothes, which were grey with dust. Although we had only gone a short distance, dust had penetrated everything, especially our parched throats. Damned country. Someone grumbled. Even the autumn's unlivable here. A second group as large as ours joined us. We were now spread over several acres of brush. A short distance away, Wesridow had just joined a cluster of officers, who were conferring beside a large radio truck entirely covered with camouflage netting, and all but indistinguishable from the leaves of the woods. Thin scraps of cloth in the whole range of woodland colors fluttered and rustled in the wind, like the leaves themselves. We were a powerful, well-organized unit. Our two groups together included 6 or 7 thousand men, about 100 tanks, an equal number of machine gun carriers, and several mobile machine shops. There were also 3 companies of light cavalry, equipped with sidecars, who were supposed to seek out the enemy and guide the unit to him. During this period, which was already very critical for the army, materiel was concentrated in motorized units, which in turn were supposed to support selected under-equipped infantry divisions. It is certain that the abundance of impeccable, well-conceived new materiel showered upon us at this time gave our morale, which had been faltering seriously since Belgrade, a much-needed lift. Soldiers once more walked about with the assured air of men who feel that everything is going well. Only Hals was miserable, because he had been forced to abandon his Emmy to a fate which was almost certainly predictable. He was inconsolable. They should cut the balls off soldiers in wartime. That would stop fellows like Hals from making things so hard for themselves, murmured War Ortenvik. Have you ever heard of eunuchs making war? Well, our chaplain put in, geldings are just as strong as other horses. Luckily, the padre had already proved that he was as much inclined that way as any of us, otherwise we would have imagined the worst and refused to listen to him. When it was dark, our formidable armored column took off. As I watched, I began to understand the powerful impression our long columns of panzers must have made at the beginning of the war, when they invaded the countries we still occupied. The roaring masses of tanks, their exhausts bursting into intermittent flame, gathered speed, and passed our heavy trucks, spreading out fanwise across the large and favorable terrain. We felt curiously moved and stirred by the sight. We drove through the deepening darkness, enveloped by a terrible uproar and din, which must have been audible for a great distance. As usual, the common soldiers knew very little about their situation, and for us this movement seemed to mean that everything was going better. We felt very strong, and in fact, as a group, we were strong. We didn't realize that a general and laborious retreat was underway throughout the central sector, approximately from Smolensk to Kharkiv, involving whole divisions and several hundred thousand men. In our case, our rate of progress was determined by the speed of our engines, but this was not generally so. Hundreds of regiments stripped of even the basic necessities were withdrawing on foot, while fighting constantly against an enemy who enjoyed an almost unbelievable numerical superiority. This time, our armies were even without the horses we had used the year before for dragging heavy machinery through the snow, as most of them had died during that winter. We were also seriously short of fuel. Everywhere, columns of vehicles in perfect condition were burned to keep them from falling into enemy hands, while the infantry plodded slowly westward in tattered boots. The Russians were well aware of our disarray and worked overtime, hoping to weaken the center army. All our available resources were placed at the disposition of certain units which were then reorganized from top to bottom and sent out to deal with particular desperate situations. This is what happened to our group, giving us the impression, for a couple of weeks, that we once again controlled the steppe. Our principal difficulty, which was clear to us even then, was the question of supply, as we always reached the pre-arranged sectors too late. At dawn, when our Panzergruppe stopped, both men and machines were grey with dust. As planned, we had reached a vast forest, which stretched right across the eastern horizon. We were allowed 2 hours to rest and put them to immediate use, as the jolting of the trucks had been exhausting, but we were wakened again before we had really slept. The weather was perfect, with a soft, almost cool breeze rustling the autumn leaves, and this perfection made everything seem easier. We jumped on board again, wreathed in smiles. Towards noon the dispatch riders, who were always quite far ahead of us, rejoined the front of the column. Brief orders were issued, and shortly afterward a large part of our group turned off for a village which was soon in sight. We could hear the sound of automatic weapons, and before we quite realized what was happening, about 15 Tiger tanks were firing at a small cluster of houses. Our heavy tractor was pulling a couple of 16-barrel rocket launchers. We were told to prepare for action, and everyone flung himself down on the ground, regretting that the tranquility of such a beautiful day was going to be disturbed. There seemed to be nothing for us to do. The tanks and one mortar unit whirled like soot around the village, which was soon blazing. In the distance, some Russian artillery, whose presence we hadn't suspected, opened a restrained fire. Several groups were detached and sent to deal with it. They returned 20 minutes later with 200 or 300 Russian prisoners. Then the tanks drove through the burnt-out village, knocking down everything which was still standing. The whole operation took less than 3/4 of an hour. Then the whistle blew, calling us back to our places, and we went on our way. During the afternoon we also flattened 2 advanced Soviet positions. The Russians were so surprised to see us that they offered almost no resistance. On the second day we reached Konotop, in a dense swarm of troops looking for transport. Our group moved to the southwest to meet a strong Russian army. We had been supplied in town under the horrified eyes of the commissariat officers, who had to give us the gas they had been saving for their own personal use. 20 minutes later, we were in contact with advanced Russian elements, which surprised us. In town, our soldiers were busy with odd jobs, like repairing bicycles. Our tanks were briefly engaged, and then withdrew on orders. We drove for the rest of the day to reach a point where, according to plan, we should have been supplied. We arrived at the dump just a few minutes before the engineers blew it up. An enormous silo filled with tin cans, drinks, and foods of all kinds was about to be burned. We stuffed our pockets and every cranny in our trucks with everything we could grab, but we had to leave behind enough to feed the whole division for several days, and the flames consumed precious provisions which would have made a great difference somewhere else. Hals watched the silo collapse with tears in his eyes, cramming as much food into his mouth as his stomach could possibly hold. The whole company witnessed the scene with regret, puffing on the cigars we'd been able to save. Then we had about 6 hours rest before returning to business. During this time, the Red Army entered Konotop, and the German forces withdrew, fighting hard as they went. Our group thrust violently into the south wing of the Russian offensive, and once again our tanks opened a passage for us through the enemy reserves, which scattered before our guns were ready to fire. However, that evening, the Russians turned away from the town, and concentrated their efforts on us. Our tanks made a half turn, and left 6 of theirs in flames. All the guns we'd brought with us were prepared to fire, and I saw our famous rocket launchers go into action for the first time. commanded by Captain Wesridal, our company and two others were used to protect the left wing of an armored detachment. Some of our fellows squeezed onto the platforms of the motorized Jesnos. The rest tramped along behind the machines, which proceeded at more or less a normal walking pace. It is strange how often the sense of having the initiative can lead men to confront an enemy far stronger than they. The progress of our panzers had seemed so irresistible during the last couple of days that everything seemed possible to us. Our three companies, in groups of 30, tramped through the relatively cool night among the ragged stands of brush scattered across this part of the plain. From the near distance, the roar of our engines filled the air, giving us a sense of reassurance, and, we hoped, a proportionate sense of alarm to the Soviets who were trying to intercept us. From time to time we could hear shots, which were undoubtedly intended for the shadowy figures fleeing through the brush. We went on in this way for about 2 miles, until suddenly we were surrounded by flares, shooting upward and throwing their light onto the ground all around us. Everyone, that is to say, every one of our 800 souls plunged down in a single movement. Our steel helmets, which in theory had a dull finish, glinted in the flashes of brilliant light. In no time, the armored cars had turned back into the brush, their formidable barrels swinging silently in search of a moving silhouette. We braced ourselves for a shower of missiles from the Russian bomb throwers, instantly aware of the shrinking sensation which comes with bad moments. 2 violet German flares shot into the sky. We knew that this was the signal to advance. After a moment of surprise and hesitation, we began to crawl forward, taking every precaution. A few men stood up, and advanced bent double. Most of the Russian rockets had already landed, and we took advantage of the lull to make a leap forward. I reached a small hollow edged with low scrub. A moment later, 2 companions caught up with me, and the sound of their quick, loud breathing betrayed the nervous tension knotting their throats. There is nothing more terrifying than moving at night through a piece of wooded or bushy country, in which every shrub might release a sudden flash of white light to dazzle and blind a moment before the intense pain which could mean the end of life. There was no way of keeping our progress silent, and for an invisible Russian waiting with his finger on the trigger any moment might present an ideal opportunity. However, everything remained more or less quiet. The enemy, who must have been very close to us, decided to stay hidden, and kept us in a state of prolonged tension. We continued to advance, slowly and cautiously. My temples throbbed, and my body was taut, ready for the plunge which might be necessary any minute. We heard a voice some 20 or 30 yards to our left, and the 3 of us shoved our noses into the dry grass. For a moment, we thought we were finished. I fitted my Mauser into the hollow of my shoulder with my eyes screwed up, anticipating the first shot. However, nothing more happened. On the left, where we'd heard the noise, 2 Russians had just surrendered to some of our men. A short distance in the other direction, the same thing happened. We couldn't understand it. What could have been happening inside the heads of these men who'd been ordered to intercept us? It's anybody's guess. Maybe they thought they were cut off from their main body of men and were afraid. For at that time, when the spirit of vengeance was the rule, the Russians were just as afraid of us as we were of them. We even thought we might have fallen into some kind of trap. An hour went by before we were ordered to regroup. During that time, our tanks went back into action, and as we silently withdrew, the flashes of their guns lit our faces with glimmers of pink light. We climbed into our trucks and started off again, apparently in the same direction as before. Dispatch riders whirled busily around our group of heavy transports. About 2 miles ahead, the tanks were apparently pushing back an enemy who was putting up only a feeble show of resistance. In these circumstances, the first light of dawn fell over our column, or rather columns, for we were out of line by as much as 500 yards, both to the left and to the right. During the night our forward troops had been firing continuously. Ahead of us, through a veil of fog, we could see a town whose name I no longer remember. The motorized troops of the Gross Deutschland were fighting through streets lined with houses with tightly closed shutters. Our vehicles moved slowly forward, with soldiers walking on either side, holding their guns, and ready for anything. We came to a small square where a group of vehicles, which included two ambulances, had stopped. About 30 Russian civilians were standing under guard beside one of the houses. We kept straight on. At the edge of town we passed several tank crews patching up minor damage. The miserable shacks all around them were on fire. We stopped for a moment and stared at what was left of these wood and straw hovels. There was no sidewalk, no orientation or alignment of the buildings. This place, like the outlying districts of innumerable Russian towns, looked like an oversized barnyard. Watering troughs or preakers obstructed without any rhyme or reason passageways which might eventually be turned into streets. Villages buried in the wilds of the steppe seemed more attractive, with their clusters of izbas turning their backs to the north. The outlying districts and even most of the town centers I saw, with the exception of Kiev, were of an incredible dreariness. We had stopped above all to wash and get water, and we knew we had only a very short time. Some men beat their clothes against trees or the sides of buildings, as if they were ambulatory doormats. Others drenched themselves with water from the preakers or wash troughs, although the day was cool and a damp wind boded no good. Nonetheless, we were frantic with thirst from the dust stirred up by our machines. German water bottles are small, so we took along extra water in anything we could find. Next, joined and encouraged by the veteran, we climbed over a low wall surrounding a small orchard. The branches of the nearest tree were weighed down with masses of skimpy, unripe pears, which refreshed our parched mouths even though they were hard and sour. We were busily picking them when a Russian popped up, like a jack in the box. He had summoned up the nerve to come out of his house, carrying a kind of bowl of braided straw full of pears like the ones we were nibbling. He jabbered a few words to the veteran, who had gone over to him. His white face was trying to smile, but was only able to manage a stiff and desperate grin. His eyes were glued to the straps of the veteran's gun belt, which crossed his chest, and especially to his spandau. "Davai," said the veteran, reaching out a hand. The Russian held up the basket, from which our friend took a pear. He threw it away and took another, which he also rejected. This was repeated some 5 or 6 times. Then the veteran began to shout at the Popov, who backed away, with nervous little steps. "They're all half rotten," roared the veteran as he came back to us. The Russian, hoping to save his orchard, had offered us the putrefying fruit he kept for his pig. As soon as we realized this, we shook the tree, which filled a tent cloth. The Popov disappeared into his lair. We could hear guns to the northwest. Our advance troops must have made contact with the enemy. We were ordered to move out. Half an hour later, we climbed down from the trucks again. The Feld's whistle was blowing for combat readiness. Fighting was in progress about half a mile away, in a small village built round a factory. Wesridow quickly explained that we had to neutralize a large enemy force which was holding the place. 2 companies had been detached for the job, the rest of the group would keep moving. With our guns slung, we walked toward the village, while our tractors pulled our rocket launchers and anti-tank guns into firing position. Almost immediately, the Russians, who were watching from their trenches, showered us with a rain of shells. If their aim had been more precise, it would have been the end of us. As it was, their only effect was to make everyone run for cover. Our 2 companies spread out and partly surrounded the fortified point. Then we had about 10 minutes of quiet, while our captain, sheltered behind a pile of stones, discussed the forthcoming action with his subordinates. The non-coms rejoined us and told us what positions we should try to reach. We scanned our surroundings as they talked, observing with our combat sense, which by now was quite well developed, every fold and hollow which might offer some shelter. Everything was quiet, and there. Instructions seemed ludicrously easy. Nothing was moving, and the silence would have been total, if it had not been for the vehicles of our armored group bumping along the rocky road below us, filling the air with exhaust and deafening noise. The Russians kept quiet, and many of us thought they had already been knocked out. The immediate presence of our main body of troops reassured us, and it seemed likely that the approaching fight would be no more than a skirmish. We were ordered to move out, and from every nook and cranny troops proceeded toward the village, bent double. Here and there we could hear someone laughing, and wondered if it was innocence or bravado. Our men reached the first houses. The Russians remained silent and invisible. I had just joined my group, which included Hals, the dear friend who so often saved me from feeling completely lost. His innocent, good-natured face smiled at me from the crowd, and I smiled back. We exchanged a look which said a great deal more than many long conversations do. The war seemed quite different to us now that we had an aerial escort. Our terrible memories of the Don, and the retreat from Belgorod belonged to the past, and to bad times which wouldn't come back. Of course, we knew that the war wasn't over, but for the last week we had been making the enemy run. We were watching the progress of about 30 of our men who were leaping through the ruins of a brickworks. 5 or 6 Panzer Grenadiers were running along beside the principal building. One of them had just thrown a grenade through a gaping window. A moment later the air was shaken by its explosion, which was immediately followed by a heart-rending scream of a kind we had often heard before. We knew that nothing must distract us from our objective. However, we saw a human figure dressed in white fall from the window and roll down to the feet of our soldiers. It was a Russian civilian, a woman, who had been cowering beside the window, probably praying to all the saints. In spite of her fall, she seemed to be unhurt, and ran toward us, screaming. One of our soldiers lifted his gun, and we thought we heard it fire, but nothing happened. The Russian woman in her white shirt ran screaming through the ranks of petrified men. No one said a word, and for a half minute, the war seemed to be standing still. Our grenadiers had already kicked in the door, and were in the house. 3 other civilians came out, 2 men and a child. Once again we watched as they ran through our astounded ranks. The Russians had not evacuated the village, and we would have to take the civilian population into account. Wesridow, who had just realized this, installed a loudspeaker on a half-track, which drove between the rows of houses waving a white rag fastened to a pole. The loudspeaker crackled out some nasal Russian words, while the 4 men on the half-track looked desperately at their comrades, who had remained in shelter. The loudspeaker must have been giving the Russians a chance to evacuate civilians or to lay down their arms. But the half-track had gone less than 100 yards when the irreparable occurred. It suddenly seemed to fly upward, as a series of deafening explosions rang out, and 5 or 6 huts disintegrated. The truck had driven over a minefield. A heavy cloud of dust and smoke hid the village from our eyes. We could see 2 black silhouettes gesticulating in the flaming half-track, and hear them screaming. "Look out for mines," someone shouted. But his voice was drowned by the roaring of mortars and packs, as the ground in front of us burst into geysers of flame and earth. Thatched roofs flew off in one piece, leaving the houses exposed, like bald men who've lost their wigs. The Russians reacted, using at least 2 batteries of heavy howitzers. Every shell landing within 150 yards of us made the ground shake under our feet, and sucked the air from our lungs. Despite the almost certain presence of mines, the assault whistles blew. Everyone left shelter and ran for the nearest embankment. Our mortars pounded the ground some 30 yards ahead of us, to disrupt the arrangement of mines, and if possible explode some of them. The Russians, with multi-barreled machine guns set up on trucks, poured a devastating fire on everything they could see. What had seemed so simple only 15 minutes earlier now looked impossibly difficult, and suddenly no one felt confident. There were 5 of us hiding in the rubble of the brickworks, and our faces, pressed into the ground, knocked against the dirt with every explosion. From another heap of shattered bricks, a non-com was shouting at the top of his lungs to fire at anything we could see. One at a time we risked looking out, but the whine of shells made even the boldest duck down immediately. Only our mortars and rocket launchers kept on firing steadily and profusely at an enemy who, for the moment, had the upper hand. In the distance, the metallic factory tower we had noticed when we arrived was proving curiously resistant to our pack shells, which must have passed right through it at several points.